Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel. They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. We've talked about it in the past. We will probably explore this in the future as well. It doesn't matter who you're talking to these days. Virtually everyone in the United States can agree some part of the justice system is broken. Criminals go free. Innocent people get locked up for years. For decades, for the rest of their lives. When the system fails, the consequences can ruin things for generations. And in today's show, we're examining this phenomenon, continuing our examination through the lens of a subject matter expert, fellow conspiracy realist, the award-winning author, photographer, podcaster, and reform activist, Gilbert King. Gilbert, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, great to be here with you guys. I'm really looking forward to this. Thank you.
Oh, man, we've been going through your new podcast, Bone Valley. What newish podcast, Bone Valley, that is available right now for everybody to listen to. And we couldn't be happier to have you on the show, man.
No, it's really exciting to see you guys again, too. That's great.
Yeah, that again refers to a panel that we all did together under the Lava for Good banner at the iHeartRadio headquarters in Atlanta, where Gilbert was one of the expert panelists talking about justice reform and many of the things Ben set up in the opening, just how so many people fall through the cracks and how perhaps some of the things that we observe as being broken about the justice system are kind of broken by design.
And Gilbert, with that live panel in preparation for that, I at least was lucky enough to hear all of Bone Valley up to that point, but we were still in media res. And what's fascinating about this story in a disturbing way is that it continues, you know, even after the tape stops rolling, as they say. Before we dive into Bone Valley, the heart of it, and this continuing saga, There are a couple of background questions we could explore. You know, you have written multiple books, Beneath a Restless Sun, the Pulitzer Prize winning The Devil in the Grove, as well as The Execution of Willie Francis. And there's kind of a common theme or thread that runs through a lot of your work. Racial relations, civil rights, the death penalty, the justice system. What inspired this specific focus for you as an investigator, researcher, and an author?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, Ben. I really wouldn't say it was like something intentional. It's just once I started with this book, The Execution of Willie Francis, which was published in 2008, all of my research just led to other ideas. And I was seeing stories like especially the Groveland Four. I found that while I was researching this Louisiana story. And I looked into this and I was like, wow, this is amazing. I'd never heard of this before. It was kind of like a Scottsboro Boys case, but in 1949 in Central Florida. And like, I'd never heard of it. And I talked to a lot of people in Florida who'd never heard of it. I talked to clerks who clerked for Thurgood Marshall, who worked on this case. They hadn't even heard of it. And so I was like, what's happening in this case that we don't know about? Why don't we know about this? And the more research I did, I saw like there was really just like some academic papers about it, but it wasn't a case that I thought people should know about. And so like once I go down that route, well, I found the next idea, Beneath the Ruthless Sun, that takes place in the same county. And so it's just sort of led one thing led to another. But, you know, even working in Florida so much as I do, you know, all of that really led to this Bone Valley podcast because I was out there doing book talks about Devil in the Grove. And all of a sudden a judge came up to me and started telling me about the Leo Schofield case. So I think it's just my proximity in Florida and the vast amount of injustices in Florida itself that just make it a really fertile ground to explore.
For those that maybe aren't familiar with the podcast yet, and if that's the case, shame on you, get on there, listen to it right now. Could you give us a little bit of the setup of just kind of what makes this Leo Schofield case special, or at least something that piqued your interest a little further than what you just mentioned in order to kind of go into a deep dive and explore it in podcast form?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's you know, it's basically the story of a young man, a hard heavy metal rock and roller, Leo Schofield, who back in 1987, he's a newlywed. He just gets married to an 18-year-old waitress. They're not even married 6 months when she disappears. She doesn't come home from her waitress shift. And so Leo, his friends, and everybody's family start looking for Michelle for 3 days. And finally, on the third day, they find her body in a phosphate canal, and she's been stabbed 26 times. Now, there's no real evidence that connects Leo to this murder. So the case kind of stalls for over a year until finally a very aggressive assistant state attorney comes in and charges Leo. And ultimately, Leo is convicted of this murder and sentenced to life in prison. And, you know, that's a common story that we hear a lot of innocent men and wrongful convictions. Nothing really there really jumps out at you as unique. What made this story really interesting is that there were some unidentified fingerprints found in the car that Michelle was driving that were never identified. And 17 years later, while Leo's been in prison, they finally match these fingerprints. And it matches to a young, very violent murderer who lives about a mile away from where Michelle's body was found. And this man ultimately confesses to the murder. And so basically we have the story, why is Leo Schofield still in prison when the man who's forensically linked to the crime scene has confessed to the murder? And that's what I set out to do, is to answer that question. Why is Leo Schofield still in prison?
And there's a lot of precedent too with this, the person who makes the confession that some detractors will consider disputed, right? Because I believe he a couple of times went back or gave mixed signals. But this is something that I think we should highlight for the real cynical people in the crowd today. It is dangerously tempting to say, oh, sure, everyone in prison is innocent, right? But Leo seems particularly unique in this regard, so much so that a judge contacted you, right? Is the first person who contacted you. Is it unusual for a judge to approach a private citizen with a case like that?
Absolutely. It's never happened to me. In fact, I was down there doing a book talk, and at the end of the talk, it was for a conference for judges, and this judge handed me his business card, and it had Leo's name on it and said, not just wrongfully convicted, he's an innocent man. And I remember taking that business card out to dinner that night with some public defenders, and I said, you know, what do you think of this, guys? This judge handed me this card at a conference today. And they all kind of were puzzled. You know, they said, a judge gave you this? A sitting judge? They're not supposed to do this kind of thing. And then as they passed the card around, one of the public defenders at the end was from Polk County, where this story takes place. And he said, I know this case. You should call him. And that kind of told me that there was something to it. And so, you know, ultimately, I ended up reaching out to this judge. And he told me, yep, they framed this guy. I can tell you exactly how they did it. And it's been bothering me for 20 years. And he set out to tell me the whole story. And You know, it was just a fascinating thing that I just could not get involved with.
Man, well, I think when you're listening through the first couple of episodes of Bone Valley, you're really put in the mind in a lot of aspects of the investigators. So the police officers that are having those initial interactions with Leo and Leo's father and the family of Michelle and really trying to put the pieces together. And in my mind, at least, I can see, and you've illustrated why there was a lot of suspicion about Leo. Because certainly his relationship with his wife was not perfect, right? And Leo had some issues. But the weird stuff comes around the time that her body is discovered. I just want to jump to one particular moment. You can expand on any of that if you want to. But that moment when Officer Richard Cacciadorian ends up calling the Schofield family to express his condolences and Leo's father picks up and says some weird stuff. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, and that was fascinating because we tracked down this officer, Richard Cacciadorian. He remembered it like it was just yesterday. And he said it was the strangest phone call of his life because he had met Leo and his father a couple days earlier when they reported Michelle missing. And now he'd seen on the news that Michelle's body was found. So he called over to the Schofields to, you know, give his condolences. And Leo's father answered and said something about finding the body. And then he made this comment that, you know, God had led him to the body, he had this premonition and led him to the body. And, you know, this place where where Michelle's body was found is really kind of, you know, it's off the beaten path a little bit. It's down in this ditch that's well off the road. And so he said, you know, this sounded to me like a confession. It was the strangest phone call of his life. And of course, the prosecutor, John Aguero, used that you know, vision from God, that premonition, very heavily in the trial against Leo. I think it was really the major part of his closing argument was, how would this guy have a premonition? He had to have known where the body was. And so that's another thing that just makes the case so interesting. You know, you talked about, you know, Leo's relationship with Michelle. And, you know, that ideally for Leo, he would have had a perfectly happy marriage. But, you know, they're two young people. They're very volatile. Leo definitely gets physical with her. You know, we talk about that in the podcast. And even he admits it. And, you know, and he said, like, I wasn't a good husband at the time. I was not the same person that I am today. But again, they had no evidence that connected him to a murder. They just had evidence showing that he wasn't a good husband, that he had a temper, that he sometimes fought with Michelle, and witnesses had seen, you know, interactions between them. And so there was a lot of like these, I would call them red herrings, but they're, you know, it's not a perfect case for Leo. You know, he's not an altar boy who just gets wrongfully convicted. You know, he was sort of an easy target, really.
Mm-hmm. And this is something too that's fascinating because the prosecution, we talk about this a little bit in our live panel, the prosecution ignores some evidence, it seems, whether through deliberate action or whether through negligence, and that they're forced to rely on these eyewitness accounts. Could you tell us a little bit about the issues surrounding convictions based on eyewitness testimony?
Yeah, well, eyewitness testimony is really not the greatest testimony. We find that out for a lot of the exonerations. A lot of times, you know, you'll have a very steady witness who doesn't seem to have a bone to pick, and they'll identify somebody and you find out later through DNA that they just misidentified. In this particular case, there was one witness who lived across the street from Leo and Michelle, and in the initial investigation, she told police that she saw Leo and Michelle come home on the night Michelle disappeared, have a big fight, lots of screaming. And then at one point in the middle of the night, she sees Leo carrying something heavy out to the Mazda, which he places in the back and drives off. She insinuates that this is a body. And now the prosecutor, John Aguero, has finally some kind of evidence, still not physical direct evidence, but it's circumstantial evidence that shows that, you know, possibly Leo was carrying a body out on the night that Michelle disappeared. And that became a very big part of the trial.
Didn't Leo have an alibi for that time?
He did. And that was the most disturbing part of this. You know, in Alice Scott, the witness who said she saw the body, she initially told police several times that she was sure that she saw Leo carry this body out between 2:30 and 3 in the morning. Well, between 2:30 and 3 a.m., Leo was out making missing persons, and he was talking to police at exactly that time across town. So suddenly, that 2:30 to 3 a.m., when it gets to the trial, it becomes 1 or 1:30. She changes her story about the timing. And that was really to make sure that Leo's alibi was no longer steady. You know, you could just clearly see that there was some movement around there with the times, trying to fit that in, to fit that witness observation. That witness, Alice Scott, later on, you know, it was really disturbing to read in the trial transcripts, because her sister-in-law, she said she watched it with her sister-in-law, and they talked about it in the driveway. Well, you know, when police came to the sister-in-law, she didn't say anything about that. And later on, when it came up that Alice had said this, the sister-in-law said, no, we did have that conversation, but that was a week or two before Michelle disappeared. It wasn't on the night Michelle disappeared. And so it was clearly she was contradicted very quickly on the stand.
You know, in the same way that Ben made the great point of how easy it is to fall into the trap of like, oh, everyone in prison is innocent. I think it's similarly easy to fall into the trap of all of these types of court cases are railroad jobs or are in some way there's a conspiracy afoot. But I think it's simpler than that and possibly even more chilling than that. There doesn't need to be a massive conspiracy to pin a crime on the wrong person. It's more about convenience than anything. Can you speak to that, about just the way the system is set up to just pin the thing on somebody? And it doesn't always matter who the hell it is.
Yeah, and that's usually the thing. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be vague about this. Like, most convictions are rightful convictions. You know, whether through plea deals or court cases, most of them go pretty smoothly. The justice system does work most of the time. But a lot of them fall through the cracks. And, you know, I've talked to prosecutors about this. And one of the major reasons this happens is that prosecutors get this tunnel vision and they start getting all this information from different sources and different witnesses, and they take what fits their theory of the crime. And sometimes you have these, you know, exculpatory evidence or a witness that totally contradicts that. They don't want to hear that. And they focus on winning the case. And it really, the prosecutor's job is to not win convictions. The prosecutor's job is to seek justice. And so that sometimes gets lost in the world of egos and careers. And sometimes you have prosecutors that just get that tunnel vision. I talked to a prosecutor who had a wrongful conviction overturned later on, decades later. And he just said to me, you know, that was tunnel vision. I had this evidence, but it didn't fit my theory, and I got caught up in it too. And so it definitely happens.
To your point, though, it's their job on paper to seek justice, but the way it works out in reality with the human failings that we all have, they end up maybe going down the wrong road. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's exactly what happens. And sometimes, you know, like you look at people and you like they, in Leo's case, they started out with this, what they call bad character evidence. Never should have been allowed, but Leo's own lawyer didn't object. And that kind of ruined things for Leo. That was one of the reasons he was convicted. His lawyer didn't object to all this bad character evidence. Most of it was temper-based. Like, I saw him punch a wall. I saw him do this kind of stuff. And by that point, you know, I saw him pull Michelle's hair. They started mentioning the 21 witnesses in a row to start the whole case. It's just too much for a jury to hear.
You poisoning the well, kind of, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the appellate courts have ruled that this is highly prejudicial to juries and that this was have to be really careful about the evidence that was allowed. But this prosecutor, he didn't get any objections, so he just kept going with it.
Because he was, in his mind, just doing his job and using what he had available, right, to argue his side. And he just didn't have that. He didn't have hard evidence, so he had to go with compromising the jury. And this is, there's a follow-up question here, Gilbert, that I know is on a lot of the minds of folks tuning in today. In your experience, does the legal system in general seem opposed to re-examining cases where convictions are seriously called into question? And if so, where does that come from?
Yeah, this is a really disturbing part. You know, there was a law that was passed around the Patriot Act, and what it did was it made appellate courts and really limited them, like the federal, the feds to come in and look at a case that's been, you know, maybe botched on the state side. So they really put many more obstacles in the way of trying to appeal and trying to overturn convictions. And one of the reasons is they're embracing this concept of what they call finality. They want to say that once a judge and once a jury has spoken, we really shouldn't go back and examine this anymore. That's more powerful than anything else that could come about. Well, in Leo's case, you have something significant. You have fingerprints, forensic evidence linking a very violent young man to the crime scene, and you also have a confession. And Leo's lawyers all along have said if the jury had been subject to learning that the forensic evidence matched a killer and he has confessed, that would be enough to lead to reasonable doubt in Leo's trial. But because of this finality in the appellate systems, they're able to just say, well, no, Jeremy Scott, the man whose fingerprints were found, he's not a credible witness because he's kind of waffled on it. He denied it. Now he's saying he did it. So you can't trust a single word he says. And, you know, my thinking all along was, yeah, you can't trust a thing that anyone says. You have to investigate. And they just shut down that investigation so quickly. They never really investigated Jeremy Scott.
To this day, correct?
Correct.
We're going to pause here for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back with Gilbert King.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we've returned.
Now that we have the name of this convicted criminal, this felon, here in the air on the show, maybe we could talk a little bit about Jeremy Scott, because, you know, going to what we said about character witnesses in Leo's case, I assume there's also no shortage of bad character witnesses for Scott. Could you tell us a little bit more about this guy?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things that we probably could have done two podcasts on this, because we had so much depth onto Jeremy Scott. We went back and investigated his life. And so, you know, we talked to family members, friends, people that he was convicted of crimes with. And really, when you look at Jeremy Scott, he's really the antithesis of Leo. You know, he's poorly educated. He drops out of school at like age 10, starts committing serious felony crimes. He's put in juvenile detention facilities. He's sent to foster homes. He's just racking up charges and charges. He sort of separates from his family. By the age of 12, he's living on the streets of Lakeland, homeless, committing crimes. And his life is just really kind of tragic. I think one of his own family members ran him over with a car and he suffered brain damage. So looking into this man's life was pretty disturbing. And we tracked down a lot of people who used to know him back in the day. And the thing they told us was he was extraordinarily violent. He was impulsive. Just at the drop of a dime, he would assault people. And, you know, we believe that he's killed four people. He's only been held accountable for one of them. He's serving a life term in prison right now. So this is the Jeremy Scott. And Jeremy Scott, at the time that Michelle was murdered, he's living on the same street right down the road from where Michelle was last seen outside of Tom's restaurant. So, you know, what's extraordinary about this kid is that if they would have, you know, back then they have something called the AFIS system, automated fingerprint identification system. It didn't really come around until like 1989. So in 1987, they couldn't run these prints through any system. But I'm still confused why they wouldn't have run these by hand, because the same detective investigating Michelle Schofield's death also investigated Jeremy Scott in one of the murders he was accused of. And he knew that this man lived right in the area where Michelle was found. So it's strange that they never went back and said, let's look at all the violent known felons living in the area, including Jeremy Scott, who was recently acquitted of a murder.
And that's who they episode 9, believed. Right?
Right.
Episode 9.
Yeah.
Is he in prison at this time already or no?
He doesn't go to prison until 1989, which is about a year and a half after Michelle was killed. So after Michelle, he killed two more people. He got caught on the last one, and he's serving a life sentence without parole.
I just don't understand. Is it a bird in the hand situation? Like, is it laziness? Like, what the hell? This guy, I mean, it just seems like a slam dunk. Why would there be such little effort put into sorting that out? Isn't that literally the job of all concerned? I just don't understand.
This is the answer for me. The same prosecutor who put Leo Schofield in prison also put Jeremy Scott in prison in 1989. Same prosecutor. So when he finds that Jeremy Scott's prints are found in Michelle's car, he can't really do this investigation because it would overturn the Leo Schofield case. And so he's kind of torn by that, and he ultimately decides to have a meeting with Jeremy Scott, no tape recorders, no witnesses. He talks to Jeremy Scott, and Jeremy Scott says, yeah, I was just a car stereo thief. I had nothing to do with the murder. That's what he initially said. And John Aguero, the prosecutor, closed the case
there. Cool. Good to go. Thank you for clearing that up, buddy.
Yes.
Oh, my. I'm
especially
just kind of blown
because
away.
There aren't a lot. In practice, it doesn't seem that there are many consequences for what we would call prosecutorial misconduct.
That correct? Comes up on the panel a lot, and I wanted to ask you about that. Is there a certain, feeling of security that these prosecutors have that maybe keeps them from not checking themselves before they wreck themselves in this situation?
Yeah. You know, this is the problem. A prosecutor can, you know, withhold evidence and, you know, let's say he finds a confession to a murder and he's like, I don't like that. Doesn't fit my thing. I'll just push that to the side and hide that from the defense and everybody. And later on it's uncovered under it's a Brady violation. You had exculpatory evidence that you didn't disclose. The worst thing that ever happens is the case gets a retrial or an appellate court will overturn the verdict. And the worst thing that ever happens to a prosecutor is he might get his name in the footnotes of that decision saying the prosecutor erred by withholding evidence. And then he goes on to do the next case. So there's like zero accountability. And I find this like impossible to believe because the power that these prosecutors have to ruin someone's life and to send them off to possibly the electric chair, which is what Leo was facing.
Godlike.
and to know that you're never going to have any accountability. This will never, nobody will ever hear about this. It'll just show up as a little footnote in an appellate decision. So it gives them even more power to know that they can't be held accountable for doing that.
Do you mind if we take our own footnote really quick and just have you explain to us what Old Sparky is?
Sure. Old Sparky was the name of the electric chair, and it was kept up at Rayford State Prison in northern Florida. And, you know, one of the things that was unusual for Leo is that when Leo was arrested, he was arrested by a detective and the prosecutor, John Aguero. And he was up in Massachusetts. They brought him back down to Florida to face charges. And Leo says, I looked over and I saw that the prosecutor, John Aguero, was wearing an Old Sparky tie clasp, holding his tie to his shirt. And he says, you know, don't you think that's kind of morbid? And Aguero said, no, I don't.
Talk about the tunnel, right? And to add on with the direction that you're going, Matt, there are some profoundly frightening statistics that are in the very first episode of Bone Valley that you mentioned pretty early on to establish the stakes here. You talk a little bit about capital punishment, the history of capital punishment in the United States in context of Florida's known struggle and problem with wrongful convictions. Could you tell us a little bit about what makes Florida so singular in these cases?
Yeah, this is actually a staggering statistic. So since the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976, Florida had sent 99 people to the electric chair or to lethal injection. In that same period, 30 prisoners on death row were found to be innocent and exonerated by DNA. So they were completely innocent. So you look at that. That's one out of every four convictions, basically, is a wrongful conviction. And that's just in the death penalty cases where they have a lot of eyes on these cases and different appeals. So you can imagine what it's like in the typical first degree or second degree murder where it's not a death penalty case. I would imagine that the statistics are even worse in that case. So Florida is the worst when it comes to getting it wrong.
So just mathematically, that would mean, would you say, knowing that context, that it is possible or even probable that some innocent people have been executed by the state of Florida?
Yeah, I think it is. I was looking into a case, Jesse Tafaro, who was executed. And you know, after his execution, it looked like they were able to find some exculpatory evidence on that one. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. And I'll tell you, I go back into the 40s and 50s. I can point to some cases that I'm almost positive that innocent men have been, you know, executed by the state of Florida. The problem going back in the 40s and 50s is the records are really scarce. You know, back in the day, if you couldn't afford a lawyer, you'd get one appointed to you, but they wouldn't necessarily keep a transcript. And so there's really no way to appeal anything. You don't have anything, any language to appeal. And so I'm positive that innocent men have been executed in Florida.
Jeez. Well, let's stay on that. Because I think there's a legacy, not only in Florida, but in a lot of places in the U.S., of, I don't know how best to put this, but I'm going to say a need for cheap labor. So let's go to something you set up beautifully in episode two. Go listen to Bone Valley episode two if you haven't heard it. You set up the history of Polk County there in Florida, the phosphate mining industry that grew there, and the need basically for ridiculously cheap labor to have people working those mines and getting that phosphate out of the earth. Just can you take us through some of that and why there might be a motive to have warm bodies in a prison?
Oh yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that you definitely see, like this chain of events. So at the end of slavery, you have Reconstruction, and at the same time is when all this phosphate is discovered in the soils in Florida. So this is a huge industry. Florida is responsible for like 3/4 of the world's phosphate. It's a huge industry in Central Florida. At the end of slavery, they have all these people who are no longer slaves. And so what do? That's the birth of the mass incarceration. So you have these Jim Crow laws that are written in, any kind of violation like trespassing, loitering, they throw these guys in prison. And then they say, all right, now you got to work. And the state of Florida charges the phosphate industry money and they give them free bodies, free labor. And so this is something that just sort of makes up for slavery in a lot of businesses. You see it, you know, in the North and you see it with the steel industry.
Sugar plantations in Texas.
Yeah. Exactly. And you can go and Google these photographs of men who are like literally handcuffed in black and white, you know, and they have really minor offenses, but they have to work off their, you know, work off their fines for free labor under like heavy guard. They're locked in cells and guys with rifles on horses.
In place of an overseer, you now have a prison guard or a warden overseeing the whole thing. And it's basically a for-profit operation. I for the longest time just thought it was like, I hear people joking about, oh, you're going to stamp license plates and things like that. And I thought that was the extent of it. You know, oh, it's a way of like learning a skill or whatever, you work in the mess hall. No, it's so much deeper and more elaborate and absolutely effed up. Yes, it's just, and I mean, yeah. Does this happen in other countries, Gilbert?
I mean, yeah, it does happen in other countries. I mean, sometimes you look at other countries and you'll see some justice things. You go, wow, the United States isn't really that bad. But there's no other country that has the mass incarceration problem that we have. And that's, you know, they sort of outlawed this debt slavery, you know, that the kind of stuff that you see forced labor in the 1930s. But, you know, it just evolves. It changes into something that's just more palpable for people to wrap their minds around. But, you know, you're still getting cheap labor from prisons.
100%. And then also, I just want to go back to something you said, Gilbert, to emphasize for anyone who's unfamiliar with this forced labor practice and the evolution of the prison system and modern policing from it, is the low threshold for crimes that you would put you in there. I remember reading cases of people being locked away for years on chain gangs or on labor camps for the crime of loitering, which could be as simple as what? Just standing in a spot?
Just standing around. I'll tell you one law that like will blow you away. In the 1940s and 50s, there was a law on the book called the Worker Fight Law. And basically, it was a law designed to give the sheriff the power to, you know, ride around his county. The sheriff is always the most powerful person in a county in the South, almost always. And it gave the sheriff the ability to, you know, if he saw two black men standing on the side of a road, and he could pull up to them, and if they were not in the armed services and they were not working that day, he could arrest them and throw them in jail and have to have them work off their fines. And they got fines. And the sheriff, by law, was able to keep the money from the fines personally, not for his department, personally. So you had all these sheriffs who were absolutely incentivized to go around, and they could go up to a black man on a Sunday who maybe worked 6 days that week. And if he wasn't in the armed service, he could arrest them. And now you've taken away the breadwinner and you throw these guys in the cell, and then you call up the orange groves and you say, I got 9 bodies and they can work for free and they got to pay off their fines to me. This was on the books in the 1940s and 50s called Worker Fight. And so that's the kind of like legacy that you have. It's left over from like you said, Noel, the overseers from slavery.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. So if we go to if we understand, you know, that Faulkner was right when he said the past isn't really the past, and we see the echoes of the consequences of this, it takes me to something really interesting that you touch on throughout Bone Valley. And there's a moment where you say, and there are multiple moments where you point out, you know, this case is different because we're kind of cooking live. We're working with live fire. We're not constrained to merely scant written records or whatever written records we can find. You're talking to people who are still alive, still active in regards to the Schofield case. And we have to ask, how was that different? What were the pros? What were the potential cons of exploring a story that still had not been finished?
Yeah, you know, this is really a great question because, you know, when I originally started this project, I wasn't thinking about podcasts. I was thinking, you know, I'm a writer. I generally don't write podcasts. I wasn't really, I'd listened to some at that point, but I really didn't know much about them. And I was thinking about writing a long feature story about Leo's case and the appellate system and why is he still in prison. But as we were down there investigating, you know, we go down and we interview Leo, and he's a phenomenal storyteller. And then, you know, all the lawyers are talking to us, the witnesses are talking to us, and we're getting these great stories. And I said, you know what, we should be recording this for a podcast. Like, this is just something really intimate. It was so different from what I'm used to, because usually I'm dealing with cases in the 40s. Everybody's dead. I'm just looking at old transcripts and documents. Here I'm talking to people who lived through it, and they're telling me, you know, in many cases, a very different story than what I saw in the transcript. And so there was like a mystery involved, and the sincerity of people, and just how they were touched by these tragedies and this violence. That was the one thing I really took away from this, just talking to people whose, you know, their lives were ruined by this case. You know, a family member's murdered, you know, a family member's wrongfully imprisoned, and fighting for this, for justice, for decades. There was something about the audio side of this and just hearing these voices crack and the pain in the voice that just doesn't quite equate when you're writing these out and they become a quote on the page.
And let's go ahead and take a moment to shout out your co-host, co-creator, Kelsey.
Yeah. Kelsey was like, you know, I often refer to as like the conscience of this story. You know, she's, you know, this young woman, it's her first job out of college. And, you know, she finds herself, you know, starting out as my researcher. And then we pivot over to the Schofield case and, you know, we're going down and all of a sudden she's got to learn how to do audio and be a recordist. And, you know, we're just sort of learning on the job.
Deep water.
Yeah, it was really deep water, and you know, it didn't come easy to us, I'll tell you that. But, you know, we spent so much time down there and got to know so many people that we became parts of their lives, and they all of a sudden just forgot about the microphone, and it was just became very casual conversations and helping us learn. And but Kelsey was just an amazing person to have along with it. She was really like, you know, we were just both like investigating and reading and just so intensely absorbed in the story. It was just a really exciting thing to be able to work with someone young who's not jaded like me, who hasn't seen it all.
You know? Yeah. Well, it's a great dynamic in this show. I want to just really quickly, guys, I want to talk about another one of these tactics that was used a lot of times to get somebody either to confess or just to get them in deeper waters within the legal system, maybe even if they were innocent. And that's the lie detector test. Because you point out in the show that Leo himself, he's the one who said, hey, give me a lie detector test. I will prove to you that I had nothing to do with this. And he willingly gets it, one of these administered to him. Tell us about what happened there.
You know, that's one of the things I think the wrongfully convicted are probably the most naive people in the criminal justice system, because I've talked to so many of them, people who have been exonerated. And one of the common themes that arises when you talk to these guys is they never want a lawyer because they're like, I have nothing to hide. I'll talk. I want to help you. And so, you know, normal people, I think, would figure like, oh, just lawyer up because you never know. Like, that's a common phrase you hear, like, don't start talking to anyone unless you have a lawyer, especially if you're innocent. It's the best time to get a lawyer. But Leo just felt like, you know, I'll talk to the detectives multiple times. I think more than a dozen times. He never brings a lawyer in. And he's trying to prove it, that he's innocent, and he's trying to help them. And at one point he says, you know, give me a polygraph. If you think that will help, I happily take a polygraph. And so they arrange it for him. And, you know, polygraphs are really interrogative tools. You know, they're not really, there's no science behind, they're not admissible in the court of law, but they're used in a way like, they'll ask a couple questions and then the administrator will say, you failed. And a lot of times people will start changing their answers, and that's what they use it for, is to put some pressure on
a
suspect.
Like, it's like psyops, basically. I mean, it's essentially to psych them out or to sort of like gaslight them into playing into the hands of the interrogator, right?
Exactly. I mean, and, you know, there's no real metric that to look at, like, whether somebody failed. You can measure anxiety, but you can't measure truth with these machines.
Well, a lot of times these folks are of lower education, and perhaps they can be manipulated into believing that this is ironclad, you know? And then, I mean, I don't know, it just makes me mad to think of the way these tools are used to manipulate people. That's all. Sorry, I'm getting...
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. In fact, you know, we talked to Jeremy Scott about it, and, you know, Jeremy I think is somebody you would, you know, has a low IQ. He's got some brain damage. And, you know, he's absolutely convinced that lie detectors are the absolute truth detectors. And he says, I want to take a lie detector to prove that, you know, he wants to prove himself. I won't get into it. It's part of the show. But yeah, I think people all the time think this is a legitimate thing. And sometimes it's the suspects themselves.
And even forensic evidence or the procedures used to obtain it have been called into serious question increasingly, right? Like things can get missed or things can get kind of purposely put to the side. When you experience these things, you're experiencing them firsthand as an interested citizen, but you are not, you know, you are not the sheriff of Polk County, right? And I don't think anybody on this call would want to be fair. But as someone who, with firsthand experience addressing these issues, what do you think more people, more members of the public need to know about the U.S. justice system?
Yeah. And, you know, this is interesting because I go around and do a lot of talks, and a lot of times I'm speaking to judges, public defenders, the prosecutor's offices, law students. I do a lot of these kind of talks and I meet a lot of people. And, you know, one of the things I think it's important for me to say this because I often meet a lot of young people who are in the prosecutor's office who are starting their careers as prosecutors. And you know, they always make a point to tell me, you know, like, we read your books. We follow these stories. It's really important to us because we're on the front lines of wrongful convictions. We're the ones who can stop a bad case from the start. And I always make a point to say, you know, no one is ever going to do a book or a podcast about a prosecutor who stopped a wrongful conviction at the very early stages because there's nothing interesting. That's the way the justice system is supposed to work. But I think that's one of the things I found, like when I go around speaking and meeting a lot of these prosecutors, like most of them, the overwhelming majority of them do not want a wrongful conviction in their office. They don't want anything to do with this. And so I think they're paying a lot more attention. You know, some of these things tend to happen in the dark. We don't, you know, the typical violent crime, we really don't know all the details. The public doesn't see them. They certainly don't follow the appellate process. So a lot of this stuff happens in the dark. By shining a bright light on it with like a book or a podcast, I think it puts people, you know, on blast a little bit, and they don't want to be seen as, oh man, that case got out of control and I'm involved in it. They don't want to be that person anymore. So I think these stories are really important to tell because they show police and prosecutors, and you know, it's not just that. Sometimes it's just a bad defense attorney. You know, in Leo's case, he had a defense attorney who did no preparation and just completely dropped the ball, later fell on his sword for Leo, but it was too late.
Now, you said something really interesting there, Gilbert, regarding the idea of messaging out, of letting the public know what's happening. Because I'm sure if most people were asked, should the justice system not convict innocent people wrongfully, I would like to think that the majority of people would say, yeah, the innocent folks shouldn't go to jail. Something else very very new happens in cases like this. Unlike cases during the 40s and the 50s into the 60s, humanity now resides in the era of endless information and social media. So there are a lot of groundswell movements for all sorts of cases, all sorts of miscarriages of justice. I'm thinking of things like leoscase.com. And there are a lot of, you mentioned social media groups that have united together behind this movement. In general, what's your take on this, which is sometimes called the court of public opinion? That might be misleading. What are the potential pros or cons of these kind of modern day movements for justice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for the word of mouth to get out about these stories. And I think it's just such a great moment in time where a podcast can reach so many people. I really don't know that if I had written a book about this, I don't think it would have reached the amount of people and gotten the amount of immediate attention. A book just doesn't have that kind of power. You know, when I wrote Devil in the Grove, nothing really happened in that case for 7 years after the book came out. Then people started reading it and saying, we got to do something about this. And it later led to the exonerations. But that took years and years and years. In this case, it was almost instantly. People were listening, tweeting about it, letting each other know. I know there was a lot of writing to the governor, writing, you know, letters of support, signing petitions. It just really kept it in the news. And the more people that heard about it, you know, the angrier they got about this conviction. You know, in terms of like the court of public opinion, one of the things that, you know, sometimes prosecutors will say, we don't want to, you know, participate with your investigation. We don't want to talk. We prefer to do our talking in the court, not the court of public opinion. And so they don't want to necessarily engage with me, which I find it kind of interesting because there's plenty of television shows out there like about catching the bad guy. And these prosecutors always go on those. Right. But the minute there's any question about, oh, you know, is this not going to be about the genius we did to catch the bad guy? No, it's actually going to be about, you know, a wrongful conviction. Then they suddenly clam up and don't want to talk. And, you know, getting back to that problem where, you know, the prosecutors are not held accountable, you know, they sort of look down on the court of opinion as if it's not legitimate for some reason, the media. You know, if I was to write a book about, say, the Groveland Four, which I wrote like 10 years ago, and in the course of my research, I found evidence that these men had confessed to the crime that I was trying to say they were innocent of. And I said, geez, that doesn't fit my story. I'm burning that paper and throwing it away or hiding it. And then say years later, somebody finds out and says, Gilbert King had the confessions in his hands, but he hid them from the public in his book because it didn't fit his story. I would like probably have that book pulled from the shelves and I'd probably have a really difficult time writing another book. So why am I being held more accountable than a prosecutor who's actually ruining someone's life with a wrongful conviction? So I don't really necessarily say that there's no pressure in public media or it's not as legitimate as the courts. I find it's just a different, the Fifth Estate, it's just a different medium, but it can be just as legitimate as what happens in a court.
Well, it also depends on whether you care about your reputation or not, or you have one in the first place. I mean, yeah. So much stuff on the internet is just chatter, and you know, the headline is what sells. And as you know, Ben and Matt and I always point out, it's really hard to get people to pay as much attention to a retraction as it is to a sexy headline that can literally wreck somebody's life. And then all of a sudden, oops, our bad. But now, because journalistic, you know, ethics standards, if there ever were any, which I know there were, but now it seems like all that's out the window because everyone's just competing with the quickest, you know, click, you know, the person that gets the story out there the quickest. And so, you know, truth be damned, we got to be first to market. And then again, those retractions don't really read quite as sexily, you know. So
you're absolutely right about that. And you know, like the one thing I start these cases, well, this one came to me from a judge, right? But you know, so it had some credibility going into it, but you know, I'm really suspicious. I really just do not want to get burned on these things. And so I you know, went down, I wanted to talk to Leo, and I spent hours with him. And you know, I'm not saying like I'm a fortune teller and I can see truth out of someone's eyes or you know, have hunches, but you know, Leo was extraordinarily open to me. And I remember thinking like, if this guy ever misleads me or lies to me, and I'm kind of done. I don't want to deal with that kind of a case where I feel like I'm not being truthful. And so he's always, you know, always been transparent. And you know, even in the other case, when another one of Jeremy's murders, where this young man was wrongfully accused, you know, we've went and visited him, and you know, you could just tell the parallels between him and Leo. Both of them were like, please look into my case. I want you to figure this out. You know, I feel like people still believe I'm guilty. And so, you know, these guys are as transparent as ever. Just find whatever you want out. And I was thinking, you know, if I got acquitted of a murder and I really did it and some reporter or journalist showed up and wanted to reinvestigate, I'd be like, yeah, no thanks. I'm good. You know?
Right, right.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break, hear a word from our sponsors, but we'll be right back with more from Gilbert King and Bone Valley.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer.
Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we've returned. Let's get back with Gilbert.
I want to tell you something that personally has given me a lot of anxiety after listening to Bone Valley. That is the 911 call that Leo Schofield makes on the night that Michelle is missing. And that's because I think a lot of us, and I personally feel like one of the first things I would do if I was in that situation is call 911 and just try and get as much information to them as possible, right? Whatever emergency services are available in my area, get someone looking immediately. But the tape of that 911 call ends up being part of the reason that Leo Schofield is looked at as a suspect. So just could you tell us a little bit about that, about why? Because it really freaks me out.
Yeah. You know, this is a horrible call to listen to because you can really listen to it two ways. You can listen to the way the defense wants you to hear it, and you can listen to the way the prosecutor wants to hear it. And you can tell he makes this call and he gets transferred over the jail because Michelle didn't have a driver's license at the time. And he was afraid they might have picked her up and maybe put her in jail for driving without a license because it had happened once before. You could just tell he's just absolutely panicked, trying to find his wife. She's like now more than 3 hours late. And you can hear him talking to his friend while he's on hold waiting. His friend Vince is right there. And he goes, "She does this to me all the time. I'm so pissed off. I can't believe if she walks through that door right now, I'm going to be so pissed." And he's saying these kind of things.
He's like, "You know how I flip out about things."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the prosecutor uses this against Leo, saying he's hopping mad and he just takes off from that. And within an hour, he has stabbed Michelle 26 times. But I listened to it and I just think it's another one of these stories. Like, he's just so frustrated because every time he files a missing person report, they don't take it seriously. They never go out and do anything. And he's like, nothing's wrong. She's 18. She never came home from work. She's supposed to be home. And you could just feel the anxiety and the distress in his voice. That's the way I heard it. I did not hear it the way the prosecutor wanted you to hear it.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, you know, there are the moments where he and his dad are functioning as a missing persons patrol, right? And they're feeling, you know, it's happened to people in the past, right? Across the United States, you might call in a missing persons and the information that any law enforcement agency will give you often is, if this person is over 18, what's the line they use, Gilbert? We can at best suggest that they get in touch with you.
If we find her, we can tell her to get in touch with you, but that's all we can do, you know, but they're not even looking. And that was like the most frustrating thing for Leo. And, you know, they're really not supposed to look. She is 18. And, you know, most of the time in these kind of cases, you know, somebody turns up later, especially like a teenager, or a young person like that. So they don't have the same kind of panic that Leo has. So the search really comes down to Leo, his family, Michelle's family, their friends, and they're just out doing these searches. What really shakes the case open is that on day two, they find her car on the side of a highway. So now they're able to retrace the car's path back to where Michelle went missing. And that's how they end up finding the body. You know, the worst thing that ever happened to Leo is his father actually found the body and made that statement that God led me to her, because that puts so much suspicion. And the prosecution just used that against him, like, constantly throughout the case.
And you have to wonder, you know, what if the defense had someone who said, God told me Leo didn't do this? Is a divine statement admissible on one side of the court, but not the other?
Right. I mean, it's staggering because, you know, this is a very like rural southern place. It's very religious. And those kind of statements are not uncommon. I mean, I saw one guy on Twitter said, he was commenting about the podcast. He says, great, Leo spent 35 years in prison because his father's the kind of guy that said, God help me find my car keys. You know, and you know, it's clear that he didn't have a premonition. The state tried to make it sound like he was telling everyone he had this premonition. He led police to the body. That's not how it happened. He found the body. And then he said, oh, God led me there, you know, that's fairly common, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so this is one of the many, many cases you get. You also mentioned that you hate to have to turn down a case. How often do people approach you for help?
Well, they approached me a lot before Bone Valley, and now I swear it's like, you know, several of them a week, and they're horrible to read because, you know, we're all aware that there's been so many exonerations in this country based on DNA. I think the 300 something we're up to now, where, you know, innocent people have been freed from prison. And so you get these letters from the mothers saying, I just listened to your podcast. I have to tell you about my son. He's wrongfully incarcerated for this crime. And, you know, there's only so many stories I can tell. These things take me like 4 or 5 years. And so I have to look at every element of it. And, you know, so it's kind of heartbreaking to be able to not like just take these on. You know, I'm not the Innocence Project. I'm just a storyteller. And so that's one of the downsides of this, is just, you know, disappointing people because, you know, they may be absolutely right, but for whatever reason, the case takes place in a different state. I prefer to work in Florida if I can. Sometimes it's not my kind of thing. I might refer it to somebody else. But it's heartbreaking to get these kind of letters. I get them from prisoners as well. And, you know, they're just kind of desperate pleas like I'm innocent. And, you know, I can't tell if they're true or not, but it wouldn't surprise me if they were true.
Hmm. Can you tell us about the one who's holding the stars, and how did that come about?
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, Leo was in a heavy metal band. He said, you know, playing guitar was his life. And when he gets to prison, Hardy Correctional Institute, they're able to form a band. And so he ends up teaching another guy who just comes in how to play guitar. They have a drummer, they have a bass player. They all sing. And so they put together this album to raise money for a victim of a murder in Florida. I believe it was Florida, the Tuthill Foundation. And so to raise money, they did a CD of all their songs. And Leo and his partner, Kevin Herrick, they write these very religious songs because they're both very religious men now. But they're very much in the spirit of heavy metal. They sound like real rock and roll. And one of the songs that Leo and Kevin had written was The One Who's Holding the Stars. And it's kind of a heavy metal version of it. And so we use it in the ninth episode when I go to the prison and you can hear Leo's version, but it became our theme song. And we had a band called Lee Bob and the Truth from the West Coast recorded their own version, slightly different, very eerie. And that became the theme. And God, it's just, it gives it such a distinct sound. And the lyrics are just so, you know, they resonate about, you know, the valley and the tear, and you're the one who's holding the stars. And sometimes you could look at that as God. I sometimes look at it as, that's Jeremy Scott. He's holding all the cards. He's the one holding the knife. And Leo, you know, is really dependent on Jeremy to come out and be truthful about what happened that night.
I mean, I just had one quick final question on my end. I recently, I think we all probably did, watch the new season of Black Mirror, which I think is a really excellent critical critique of culture and communications and, you know, the internet and the way things have kind of spun out of control with technology. There's a really great episode that sort of lampoons true crime. It's called Loch Henry, I believe, if that's the name of the town in Scotland. And I don't want to give anything away about it, but it's just, check it out if you're into it, if it's something, because it just shows how, you know, there's this thirst, you know, for exploiting the misery of others, you know, for the entertainment of the masses, because in podcast space, I think it's something that we've all just seen explode. And, you know, I'm not here to criticize anybody's taste or the kind of stuff anybody wants to make, but it does seem to me like these wrongful conviction stories are not the same as just retreading a murder and retreading horrible things that families have gone through for the purposes of like telling a story and making a buck. I just wanted to get a sense of your perspective as someone who investigates these things, where that drive comes from, and if you have any thoughts about sort of maybe the broader, more prurient version of what true crime has become.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I grew up reading a lot of true crime. And I remember distinctly when I was young and the Son of Sam murders, living in New York, and just the immediacy. This is before social media. Like the headlines on the Daily News, Son of Sam strikes again in New York. And like all of a sudden, the killer is writing to Jimmy Breslin, the columnist, and telling him he's going to strike again and giving him clues. And I remember just being so fascinated with that criminal element of it. As I got older and as I started writing my own books, I think one of the things that really stuck with me is I still use true crime or crime as the narrative. I almost look at it as like the Trojan horse. I'm going to give you the narrative and it's based in crime, but I'm really telling a very different story, whether it's, you know, about civil rights and race in the 1940s, whether it's, you know, post Brown versus Board, racial relations and some of the crimes that happened then. And even in Bone Valley, you know, it's not so much about Michelle's murder. It's really more about how does a wrongful conviction happen? How does a man who has all this evidence pointing to somebody else remain in prison? And so that's really what I wanted to do with this story, was really just focus on those questions. But, you know, there is a crime element to it. And I don't really back away from that, because I think it's one of those things that gets people involved in the story, and you come away saying, wow, I just learned a lot about appellate law. I just learned about a lot about, you know, this and how the courts work. And those are the things that really interest me. So I think you can use crime to get there.
Oh, no question. 1,000,000%. Yeah. I don't want to come off sounding like I'm you know, coming down on true crime genre. I just think there are versions of it that are more exploitive than others. And I think that don't have that Trojan horse element, and that really are just there to kind of titillate and shock, you know, rather than actually teach somebody something or have sort of an aspect of, I don't know, humanity to them. Yeah. So I just wanted to say, I think it's great the kind of work that you're doing and the way that you do sort of sneak the vegetables into the spaghetti sauce. You know,
that's a great way to put it, but you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you. Yeah.
And that's something I'd like to echo that point as a personal thanks. Bone Valley is a very human exploration, and it's education about a process, right? And if we were to say it's about crime, then I would caution people from thinking it is solely about one crime. It is a in-depth examination, but along the way, we're talking about the other crimes, like the crime of wrongfully convicting someone. And when we first spoke regarding this, we were coming together right before a milestone in the Leo Schofield case. We don't want to get too much into that. You'll have to listen to the podcast to learn the ins and outs. But Gilbert, were you expecting for there to be bonus episodes of the show coming out when you started research and production, or when you decided it should be a podcast?
No, you know, we really didn't have any idea about that. I think we sort of ended, you know, the way we did at the end of episode 9 and, you know, asking the question again, you know, this may be the closest to justice we ever get. You know, why is Leo Schofield still in prison? I think one of the things about the bonus episodes was that it started to, you know, we knew Leo had a parole hearing coming up, and we knew that, you know, this podcast had now reached millions of people, and there was sort of an outrage, and locally they were feeling it. Within the state of Florida, they were feeling it. It was getting a lot of attention. People were writing. It was clearly something was different. And you know, what else was really interesting was Judge Cupp, who quit and resigned his seat on the bench to represent Leo. So he comes out of, you know, giving up his seat on the bench and becomes Leo's defense attorney. And so, like, the parole hearing now has this really urgency to it. And so we sort of cover all that. And, you know, it was just last month we show up at the hearing. And, you know, you can listen to the episode. It's like a roller coaster of emotions for me personally, for everybody involved in the podcast, for Leo, for everyone who was there. It was extraordinarily emotional. And, you know, we never expected that to be a part of the series, but that's just the way it sort of developed, I think, because the podcast had these listeners who really cared about it, and they put pressure on the state of Florida.
And that's pressure that continues in the modern day. The story of Leo Schofield is not yet finished, as Gilbert, you can be the first to assure us. I think one of the big questions that a lot of listeners have now is where they can learn more, not just about Bone Valley, but about your previous, past, and future work.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mostly focus in Florida. The last couple of books I've written, Devil in the Grove and Beneath the Ruthless Sun, are set in Central Florida, not too far away from Polk County, where Leo's story takes place. And I think Central Florida is a really fascinating place. There's an expression you get in Florida that says, you know, the further north you get, the further south you get. And that's like, you know, you're starting in Miami, which is this multicultural, like the capital of Latin America, basically. And once you start going north, you know, you get into that Central Florida, it's cowboy hats, it's cattle. It looks like you're in Texas. I mean, as far as the eyes can see, these prairies. It doesn't look like the Florida that you see on the postcards. And so that part of Florida has just sort of always been off the radar. And I've had so many people say, like, come on, this is like a half hour outside of Disney World. How bad could it be? And I'm like, come on down with me and we'll go a half hour outside of Disney World and you tell me what you see.
Well, the whole Florida man narrative. I mean, exactly. We've talked about that. And I mean, obviously, I'm sure you know, as a researcher, you know about all the sunshine laws and the way things get reported. Is that something that you've run into in your reporting, or do you find stories like through kind of transparency?
Oh, yeah. I got to say, the great thing about Florida is the sunshine laws. Like, you can get just about everything you want. Florida keeps great records and they give them out. So, like, I could probably find some really interesting cases in Alabama and Mississippi, but I can't always get the records and the access to the inmates.
That's interesting.
So that's what really helps me a lot is these sunshine laws. And hopefully those things were strong enough to last, because I think it's been a really valuable thing for the state of Florida. And I just want to add one thing. I do spend a lot of my time beating up the state of Florida criminal justice system. But I do want to say in their defense that, you know, in the past, these gross injustices that I've laid out, like, for instance, in Devil in the Grove, the state of Florida has acknowledged it and corrected it. And I see that in the state of Florida. And I see that, I want to make sure people understand, like, I don't see that so much in Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, where these gross injustices from the past are being corrected. So I give Florida a little bit of credit, as heinous as some of these wrongful convictions are, that they have shown in the past that they are willing to correct them.
Have you ever spent much time in Clearwater? I feel like there might be a story about real estate in Clearwater, maybe, that could be explored.
Yes, there's a, you know, there's no end, there's no shortage of those kind of stories, especially near the coasts, you know.
You can also check out gilbertking.com to learn more about not just Bone Valley, but Bone Valley news, current and ongoing developments in the Leo Schofield case. We mentioned leoscase.com to learn more. You can also, Gilbert, I hope this isn't a step too far. If you go to the website and you have a lead, some insiders have following questions, there is a way to contact Gilbert directly.
Absolutely. And anybody can contact me. I answer everybody. I mean, I'm not John Grisham where I'm getting millions of letters like that. I answer everybody. So yeah, feel free.
Well, thank you so much for your time today with us, Gilbert. And as we say, you know, we really only do interviews or hang with guests when we believe in the work. And I think we can all agree that what you're doing is profoundly important, directly for the case of Leo Schofield, but also for the case of the doubtlessly thousands of people who are currently waiting for justice.
Wow. Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed this conversation so much, and I can't thank you enough for having me on.
What a ride. There is something we should tell everybody in the interest of full transparency, guys. There are developments that happen with Bone Valley that we leave to Gilbert and the show. You'll have to tune in to learn about them.
Definitely. It's one of those shows that once you begin it, you get fully engrossed. Like, I couldn't pull myself away. I don't know about you guys when I was listening. So I would just highly recommend checking it out if you get a chance. And what a great guy.
Yeah, just overall, just, I mean, you can tell he's passionate about what he's investigating. He's not just doing it for attention. I mean, it's something that he truly believes in, and he's got a goal, which is to try to, you know, shed light on these cases that are grossly underreported in many ways. So thank you to Gilbert for your time.
Mm-hmm. And now we pass the torch to you, fellow conspiracy realists. What do you think? Not just about this case, but do you have any other examples of what appear to be miscarriages of the American justice system? And what do you think this story can tell us all about the justice system in the United States overall? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Come be a part of the show with us. We try to be easy to find online.
Conspiracy Stuff is the handle that we go by on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram and TikTok.
We have a phone number, 1-833-STDWYTK. It's a voicemail. Leave us one, please. Give yourself a cool nickname, and then you've got 3 minutes. Say whatever you'd like. Just at some point, let us know if we can use your name and voice on the air. If you don't want to do that, hey, why not send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.